이번에 문제 이번에 우리 Ministério especialmente em termos da minha guia, a professora Agnes Cadan, volia simplesmente explicar um parente de detalhes do funcionamento desta semana. Funcionarem da seguinte maneira: procuraremos aos dias começar às 10, porque a minha segunda dia, que isto é inicial, é que procuraremos começar às 10. De 10 a 12, mais ou menos, hi haurà la sensació amb el debat. A les 12 hi haurà una petita pausa, amb cafè aquí fora. I després d'això, els amics acompanyants de la professora Hera, John Drum i Katie Teresakis, faran una sessió complementària, ho tenen a la carpeta, de temes que ens ajudaran a entendre encara més el pensament d'Agnes Hera. Avui començarà el doctor Teresakis, demà ho farà John Gramley, demà passat Teresakis, dijous John Gramley, i divendres hi haurà un petit canvi. Divendres, per ser divendres, la professora Heller farà les seves dues sessions al dematí, de manera que quedin lliure a la tarda. Ens ha semblat que era més prudent que la tarda del divendres quedés lliure. Recordin també que el dimarts, també està a la carpeta, el dimarts ella farà una conferència oberta, pública, a la Mercè, on happiness, sobre la felicitat. Bé, pel de més, el funcionament de les activitats de la càtedra és com sempre, tindran a la seva disposició doncs, els companys. Dic això perquè és que jo mateix simplement vinc aquest matí a presentar l'acte, però la veritat és que, ara no ho veuen, però vaig amb un collar rígid, perquè aquí no es veu. Ara és virtual, ja. Perquè tinc un problema de nervis cervical severa, avui entro a l'hospital i demà m'opera. Espero que ara he vingut i faig la presentació amb molt de gust i em sap molt greu de no poder ser aquí, però no estranyi que en el transcurs de les setmanes hi hagués que estaré fora de combat. Però hi haurà els meus companys que podran resoldre qualsevol situació. We are extremely happy, Agnes Hera, that you are here and honored. It's a great occasion to know, well, we all have read a lot of what you have written in the course of your life, but it's an extraordinary occasion to have you here to discuss with you, to debate with you the main topics that interest you. And we have also invited John Gramley and Kitty Teresakis, and we are happy that they could come. Thank you very much for being here the whole week, so that, as I explained, each day after your morning session, you will have a complementary session by them, and just on Friday, you will concentrate your two sessions in the morning, so that in the afternoon you are free and we have finished with the sessions of the week. Thank you very much to all of you. I hope that after each talk there will be a debate, a discussion of the topics treated by Agnes Hera or by our colleagues. And I hope that the whole of this week will be stimulating and rewarding to all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, because this is a kind of a seminar, and after the talks we are concentrating on the questions and our contributions. So it is good if we understand each other, you understand me and I understand you, without mediation of this technical device which distorts the voices anyway. This is a series of lectures. The lectures are about the world, which is a very broad topic. And all the other lectures be illuminations of the main topic. Today I'll start with a general talk about the world as such, and in the following lectures I want to explain or interpret different aspects of my talk of today. Since I know that you understand English, of course you are Catalonian, and I try to speak slowly. If I stop talking slowly, which can happen to me, please raise your hand and tell me it's no doubt, because you don't understand. If you don't understand something, I'm going to repeat it. So I think the main thing to understand each other, because I want ideas to get through and to discuss, not only to speak to you in this auditorium. So we start with the word. The concept of the word is not a traditional metaphysical concept. Of course, it occurs in metaphysical thinking during the Middle Ages, and even in modern times, because you know that God created the world, and for the Christians it has God became a category which they had to address. But the concept of world started its great career in modernity. It was basically Schopenhauer who wrote this book about the world, as being a representation, and from Schopenhauer onwards, Nietzsche, Heidegger, Scherer, Internis, and all of the significant philosophers started to talk about the world as such. Wittgenstein said that the world is the total of the facts, that is, the world is the sum total of facts. He said in his book on Tractatus. But the same Wittgenstein said something else too. He said that the world of a happy man is entirely different from the world of an unhappy man. They are entirely different two worlds. How can you see these two things together? On the one hand, the world is the sum total of facts. On the other hand, the world of a happy man is entirely different from the world of an unhappy man. How can be the sum total of facts different from a happy man and for an unhappy man? This is one of the questions I want to address today. The other question I want to address is basically an illuminational interpretation of a poem by Goethe. I don't want to read the poem by Goethe in German, but I translate it in bad English. He says, everyone who comes to the world, builds a house. He leaves this house for a second person. The second person changes this house, but no one finishes to build this house. That everyone who comes to the world builds a house. The second builds it further and changes it. But no one will build it to the end. It will never be finished, never be a finished house. Now for this you have to understand that in the German, in the very common, that is, you come into the word means to be born. And in many languages, I don't know the Catalan yet, to get into the word means to be born, and to leave the world means to die. And to go from one world to the other world means to go from mortality to immortality, to eternity. That is, the world and life, human life, God was synonymous in the understanding of the term God. This is why the concept of God became so important in modern philosophy, because the problem of mortality, of being limited enterprise, of our limitedness in general, became the center point of modern thinking. That's why the world occupies such an important place. We come into the world, we are born, we are living, being in the world, as Heidegger said, who has loved to say about the world, being in the world means to live. That is, if you are in the world, means that you are living. And everyone has a world, according to Heidegger. And for him also, being in the world is one of the central categories. It means, in fact, human life. Heidegger even asked the question whether the animals had a world. And the answer, the animals have no world. Only humans have a world. And this conception of the world is already, of course, also by Heidegger, a modern conception of the world. So these are the fundamental questions I want to address today. First, I talk about the world in singular, as if believed only in one word, world in singular. Because I want to explain what does it mean to be alive, to live in a world in singular, that is, to live in general. And then I go to the question about the words in plural, many words, because it will turn out that we do not live only in one single world, we live simultaneously or consecutively in different worlds. So first I start with the world in singular, and later on I come to talk about worlds in plural. The world in singular. Now, we come back to the problem of Wittgenstein. I repeat, it is in the same book, Tractatus, that the world is the sum total of facts, and the world of the happy man is entirely different from the world of the unhappy man. And it returns to the question, how can you interpret these seemingly contradictory statements? Let me return to Immanuel Kant. In his metaphysical system, he says very little about the world, it's just an idea of reason. But in his pragmatic anthropology, he says something very, very important about the world. He says that we have distinguished between two different things, to know the world and to have a world. That is, that's not identical. The world we know is always broader than the world we have. When we have a world, it means that we are familiar with the rules and the norms of this world, that we can move in this world, that we are acquainted with our environment, that we know what to expect, that we understand the sentences without footnotes, that we do not need a kind of philosophical or scientific or informative thing about this world. We are familiar, that is familiarity. We have a world, we move there, it's a practical relationship. We are familiar with this world. To know the world is a different thing. To know the world, in knowing the world, we have a contemplative relationship in to life. To know the world, you can know far more. You can know a lot of things about the sky, about the stars. You can know something about the African continent. You can know something about biological constitution. But this is knowledge. You have a contemplative relationship to it. It belongs to your world because your information belongs to your world. But it is still not the world you have, because you cannot really move, you are not acquainted practically with this world, although you have information about this world. That is the practical relationship. And the relationship is basically, these with informations are different situations and different relations to the world. The two, however, are connected in one way to another. The world you have very much influences the world you know. If you are born in a world with which you are acquainted, but there is very little information, for example, about geography or about history, then the world you know will be not much broader than the world you have. However, if you are born in an environment like this, for example, then the world you know will be far broader than the world you have. Because you have access to books, you have access to information, all this thing to television, which gives you a lot of knowledge about the world, but you do not have this world. You cannot act for or against this world. It's very unlikely that you will be ever able to act for or against this world. That is, the difference is that within practical relationship, the world you have and the other, the world you know. Let me now return to Vidyashaya. That is, the world is the sum total of fact. And the world of the happy man is different from the world of the unhappy man because they are two different worlds. How can you understand it? If you try to apply the Kantian distinction between having a world and knowing a world, you can say the world we know is the sum total of facts. But the world we have is a world which is so different for the happy man and for the unhappy man. The world we have is indeed different for all the kind of people who do have a world. So you can say that Wittgenstein hasn't really formulated a kind of aporia or a paradox here, but he addressed the question of the world from two different positions. From the position which is contemplative, which is epistemological, and the other which is, let's say, ontological. And from an epistemological standpoint, the world is the sum total of the facts. Whatever the facts are, this is another matter, doesn't belong to our topic. And if you speak about the experience of the world, then this is the world of the happy and the unhappy man, because their life experience is different. That's why the world will be entirely taken out. Now, if you have a world, what characterizes you to have a world? As a newborn, you are thrown in the world. That's also Heidegger. You are thrown into a world. To be thrown into the world is to be thrown into nothing. Or, Sartre would formulate it that way, you are thrown into freedom. Because at the moment when you are thrown into the world, the moment through birth, you do not yet have a world at all. You neither know the world, nor do you have a world. From the moment of your birth, you start what we can call world expansion. You start to have a world. In the moment you are born, you are a stranger, that's why you do not have a world. The stranger gets a world and expands himself, herself in this world. But the moment the stranger starts to have a world and gets expand this world, a world expansion, the stranger becomes a prisoner. This is what I want you to understand. You are born as a stranger, and to the extent you cease to be a stranger, you become a prisoner. You become the prisoner of the world into which you were thrown. You become a prisoner of the world into which you have been thrown. What does it mean that you are a prisoner? It's a prisoner of the world because you are born in a specific place in a specific time. There is a horizon in each and every world you can be thrown into. And you cannot look, of course, in principle, beyond the horizon. You are first imprisoned in your historicity, in the time and space in which you were thrown into the world. This is one aspect of your prison. And this is the prism also of the world you know, not just the world you have. You know a different kind of world now, imprisoned in our world, than you could have known in a world 2,000 years ago, imprisoned in that world, for example, in Central Asia, to give an example. That is, in the world you know is a kind of a prison, prison house of historicity. You do not know the future at all. But in the case of the world you have, you feel this prison situation far more, and I tell you why. Because the world you have is the world of the mutual emotional dependency. You know that you have a world because you enter the chains of the mutual emotional dependency. The moment your mother takes you in her eyes, you are already in the situation of mutual emotional dependency. And as long as you live, you remain in the situation of a mutual emotional dependency. This is also a prison house. You can say that dependencies are manifold. And when I said mother and child, it's not just emotional dependency, it is economic dependency as well. You are dependent on food, you are dependent on drink. You are dependent on low clothing. That's not just emotion. There are many, many different kinds of dependencies. There are economic dependencies, political, institutional dependencies. There are several multifarious dependencies. But each and every dependency is simultaneously also an emotional dependency. This is basically one of the main reasons of our fragility. That is, humans are fragile creatures because we can be hurt, constantly can be hurt. Given the mutual emotional dependency, we suffer most from betrayal, from neglect, from withholding love, from withholding recognition, from everything which is related to the mutual emotional dependency. It is precisely by noticing this that philosophers of an old brand, we call them nowadays metaphysical philosophers, devised a system in which knowing the world was superior to having the world. That metaphysical philosophers wanted us to get rid from the emotional dependency, get rid from this prison, which is basically having a world, and living in another world, a world we know, but we do not need to have, a world which is beyond all emotional dependencies. This is why philosophers, metaphysicians believe that we can become entirely happy, entirely satisfied, entirely without needs, entirely autarkic, entirely autonomous, if we get rid of our sensuality, of our sensual experiences, of our emotions, of our feelings, which are all related to our dependencies. That is, as philosophers used to express themselves, heteronomous. We are heteronomous, we are dependent, we need to be autonomous, we need to be independent. And this we can achieve only if we do not have this world. If we arrive to another world, that another world which is not this world anymore. The first person who formulated this succinctly was Aristotle, at least according to the report by Diogenes Laertius. Diogenes Laertius said, whether true or untrue is another matter, that Aristotle once declared the following: I am the friend of Plato, but I am more the friend of truth. Or in another translation, I love Plato, but I love truth more. What does it mean? It means exactly the same thing what I said. If you love Plato, you are having a brother, because you are in an emotional dependency from someone else. You love Plato, but Plato maybe does not love you. There is no guarantee that Plato will love you or you love Plato. Anyway, Plato loves not only you, loves other people, maybe better, maybe more, can also be disagreement with you. So this is always a source of tension. The love to Plato is a constant source of tension. There can be traumas in this life. Maybe Plato will betray you. Maybe he will be untruthful to you. Maybe, he does before me. And that's a cause of terrible unhappiness. Because the person whom we love can die before us, can become sick, and will make us unhappy, and our world will become an unhappy world. Because a friend dies before us or gets sick, that will be an unhappy world. How can we get rid of this unhappy world? You have to love someone else, and this something and someone else is truth. Now, if you love truth, you are no more in the relationship of emotional dependency. Of course, the love of truth, the love of wisdom, is love. But truth will not die before you, will not get sick, will not abandon you, will not betray you, will not be unfaithful. Truth is truth. So, you are not dependent. You are independent. And Aristotle described this. He spoke about autarkia. Autarkia. That those who are completely loving the truth do not have any needs at all, because they are entirely independent. They don't even need friends, because that's a total independence from everything else. You're the love of truth. You get rid of emotional dependency. So the world will know if you are able to put in all your love, all your feeling, emotion into this world, into this something called truth, then you will be happy. That is felicity. And you cannot be unhappy. That is amor del intellectualis of Spinoza. Yeah, the intellectual love of God. Spinoza knew that in the relation of amor del intellectualis, you can only be happy. That's felicity. You are no more dependent on anyone, because you are totally invested in this love of this God, which is not even a personal God, because a personal God could be angry, a personal God could punish you. That is an emotional relationship. But this God is impersonal, this God of truth is impersonal. Substance. You love the substance intellectually. That's all. And then you get rid of all troubles, you cannot have traumas, you cannot be unhappy, you will be happy. And of course that's also the sum total of all the facts of the world. Yeah? Because of course all modes are related to the substance. So if you have them together, you can like the sum total of facts together in this love of the non-personal God called substance by Spinoza. That's the great dream of all the metaphysicians, gathering for emotional dependence. This world, however, is not a world we have. This is a world we know. How can you distinguish between the concept of world and the concept of truth? This is the truth which we know and which we love, but is no more, we are no more dependent anymore. Autonomy. How can you distinguish? I would suggest that even the language, our language, every language, makes this distinction. The problem is whether you can say mine or you cannot say mine without changing the meaning of the sentence. Now I can say my family. I love my family. I love my children. I love my country. I love my religion. I love my university. I love my beloved. Yeah? That you can say. I love also your country. I love also your friends. Your friends are my friends. I can say that. I can say I love, you love, we love. Yeah, we love ours. I love our country. I love our friends. We can say that. Can I say, I love my truth? If I say I love my truth, the meaning of the concept of the truth is changing. I cannot say I love my truth, I love our truth, I love your truth, I love their truth. How can you say that? Because then it is no more truth. Truth is big truth. If I say my truth, I don't say big truth. But what I love, what is Aristotle's saying? Aristotle said, I love the truth more than I love Plato. The truth is more powerful than Plato. I love the truth, I do not love my truth. Because if I love my truth, then I acknowledge that my truth is only mine. And you have another truth, and the other has another truth, and so on and so forth. Then there is no such a thing as the truth. But I stick to it. There is such a thing as the truth. And the truth is not even only mine. I think Schoenberg understood this very well in his opera, Moses and Aaron, when Moses says, I love my idea and I live for it. He hasn't said, I love my truth. He said, I love my idea. You can love our idea, but you cannot love my truth, our truth, because it's always the truth that we love. This is what the language makes the great distinction. A quote. When you say, I love my country, I love my family, I love our country, I love our friends, etc., we can safely express something, two things. First of all, we express identity. In the case of my country, our country, we express so what we call identity. This identity is not an identity without distinction, without difference, there is always difference, but this whole identity, we identify ourselves with this country, with this person, with this lover, with this mother, with this child, we identify ourselves, this is ours, this is identity. But this identity means also something that Kierkegaard expressed so beautifully. Kierkegaard said, if I say my God, it doesn't mean that God belongs to me. It says that we belong to him. That is the expression, my, is a mutual emotional dependency. Yeah? It's not an expression of property relationship. That is my child doesn't mean that the child is my property. It's always a reference to I belong to her, not just she belongs to me. It is a mutual emotional dependency. That is when I say my, I speak out a kind of identity, then I also make a statement about having a world. When I say my, I am making a statement of having a world. They belong to me means I belong to them. I am committed to them. I act for them or against them. They are in my action radius, so I can act there for them. I can act against them. I can speak in this sense. Now, I leave for this moment the problem of word in singular. Now, you see what I meant by a word in singular in terms of Wittgenstein. That the word is on one hand the sum total of facts. On the other hand, the word we have is a word of mutual emotional dependency. It can be a happy word or an unhappy word, depending how successful we are in this relation of mutual dependency. That metaphysical philosophers wanted to get rid of mutual dependency. They wanted us to get rid from suffering, from traumas, from being exposed to being the prisoners of a world, wanted to liberate us from this prison house and show us the light of truth, which is a truth which we can love, but from which we are not dependent. Now let's make for a moment go back to the problem of Goethe, and the poem of Goethe. Whoever is born, that is, comes into the world, constructs, creates a house. The next who comes creates it further. But it will never be finished, never be worked on. Now this conception, this poem, is fitting on both cases. Also on the case of having a world and the case of knowing a world. In both cases we come into a world, we build a house, and we already find a house which was built before us, and we modify it, but no one will finish it. But what happens? It still will be finished. Because it has happened in history. How do we know that it has happened? That the house was built to the end, and that's it. No one could build it further. Because there are several cultures which are entirely lost. We do not know anything about them unless we dig underneath, dig underneath, and as in archaeology, we find ruins, we find statues, and we see that used to be a world here. There was a world here. But we do not know anything about this world, only those things which show in the stone and in the statues, and perhaps in pergaments we cannot read anymore. Because everything was lost from this world. The world was built to the end, and this is why we have got it as our heritage. It's not our heritage anymore. This world we cannot have, of course. We cannot even know. We cannot even know because we can know a world only approximately. I'm going to speak about this very soon, approximately, only if it can continue. If you can continue in a way this kind of world. If you cannot continue it, you cannot speak even about the knowledge of this world. Let me now continue. I speak about having more worlds than one. Because we do not live only in one world. We are living constantly in more worlds than one. Growing up means to enter different worlds. First of all, I want to speak at the more primitive aspect of having different worlds. There is no human culture without having different worlds in the most primitive, everyday sense. Having the world means that you're familiar with something. You know how to use things. You know how to obey laws and rules, etc. Even in this primitive understanding, in a very simple environment, we live in many worlds. There is a world for children. There is a world for men and there is a world for women. It's not exactly the same kind of a world. And a little more complex culture. A boy leaves the peasant environment, leaves the village, goes into the city, from one world to the other world. A girl goes into the family of a stranger, the family of the future husband. Again, an entirely different world. You don't know it necessarily. And you move into the school. You go to the school. Then you enter also into a different world. In very simple ways, you have to enter always in another kind of world and relearn. And think it will be familiar with you. If it will become familiar, it will be your world. But then you enter another world which will be is still unfamiliar at the moment you enter. That is a really different world. 1, 2, 3, you go back to the peasant environment, you know this world, you go back to the city, you must know this world, you get to the family of your husband, the family of your father or mother, etc. They are different worlds, not necessarily essentially, but in many things different. Far more complicated is when we speak about cultures. Culture, I speak about culture in the understanding of my friend George Marcus, the anthropological concept of culture. John knows much about this, because he wrote about it. That is, the culture is basically some children of the norms, rules, habits. It's a form of life. Culture is a form of life. Every human community is a culture because there are preferred forms of life everywhere, various forms of, there are also preferred forms of life in every kind of human community. And in this respect, my world is my culture. It is a form of life, a complex form of life, in which all his former corpus of life belong. That is the school, the peasant environment, the city, etc., etc. And all this belong. It is a kind of form of life. This is my culture. In the same way, my culture. It belongs to me and I belong to it. And because I'm familiar with it, I understand everything in my culture. But that is my culture only. But I will use this term, it's totally insignificant. You normally don't use this dual culture. And there is another world. Yeah? My world and the world of the others. The world of the other is the world of the stranger. And if I am familiar with my world, I normally also familiar than the others, the strangers. Different forms of life. A different religion, for example. Different concepts of good and bad, sacred and profane. A different concept of a success and failure. Yeah, those people out there, they are different from us. This is a different world. And our world, and their world, the other worlds, that is different kind of worlds, a different kind of culture. They are the strangers. We are not familiar with them. And normally, we have very funny concepts about the strangers. First and foremost, since we are familiar with our world and not familiar with the world of the strangers, we have a different picture about ourselves than the stranger can have from us. That's natural. So as a single person sees himself or her in an other light, then another person will see him or her. The same way, you don't recognize your voice, but you hear inside from the voice on the record, in the same way. A person who belongs to a culture will see her own culture in different light than a person who belongs to another culture will look at this culture differently. Obviously, we see ourselves in a more flattering light than others see us because we are familiar, and everything is familiar, we are considered right or true. So we identify ourselves as identity over time, and we say, we identify ourselves with our own world, and this is a good one. We know what the truth is, we basically are doing the right things, and the others that do not know what the right thing is, because they live in another false world or a problematic world at least. That means that what I call natural prejudice is really natural. That is, we all have prejudices. Please take care of it. We are all prejudiced. And because we are all seeing ourselves in a different light than the others see us, and we see others in a different light than they see themselves. These prejudices are not necessarily also dangerous prejudices. They become dangerous prejudices only if the others see not just something we are unfamiliar with, but also as something hostile, not just something strange, but something devious, not just something unknown, but something threatening. Then our prejudices become dangerous prejudices, aggressive prejudices. But if we see ourselves in different light than others see us, they are natural prejudices and they are not yet dangerous. So I think it's very important to make this distinction. But then we have all the different words. It can happen the other way around. It can happen that we do not like our world at all. And the world of the other shines in the light of the attraction. That we say they are better than us. We should be like them, not like ourselves. So not necessarily, the prejudices are not necessarily on the side of our own culture, sometimes on the side of the other. Sometimes we prefer the other. These are the culture words. Now we live in different worlds. One world we have, the other world we know, other worlds we know, and sometimes we can live in two or three different cultures, no more perhaps, two or three different cultures, two normally, then we have two worlds. We can have two worlds, especially in modern times. I thought just in modern times, any time when was one word expanding, I give you an example. It was an example in Hellenism, in the Hellenistic culture, that basically Middle Eastern people lived in their own culture and also in the Greek culture. They lived in two cultures. That is possible. And it is possible even more today, and it used to be, because we have different opinions and different rules, so to speak, about culture difference nowadays. Now, can we live in the future? Can we live in the past? Because we can have, in our culture, we have a relationship to the past of our culture. I will talk about this in details the day after tomorrow. So I really cannot talk about this because I know in every lecture the time is limited. I cannot talk much about this. I only suggest you something. I'm going to talk about this on Wednesday. I suggest you something, and this thing what I suggest you is the following, that we can absorb in our world, in our world we know, and even in our world we have, only those kind of past cultures which live also in our culture, which constantly live in our culture. And this is why it was very good, very beautiful from Hegel, that he distinguished between two concepts of remembrance and recollection. But in the case of recollection, we recollect something which is our own past and we can absorb in our culture. In the case of memory, memorizing, we seek something which has happened in past time without embracing it, without incorporating this something in our way of life, or in our fruitful knowledge about our way of life. This was, we spoke only about two kinds of words in plural. World in plural, world of children, husbands, wives, etc., the very small community, or moving from a village to the city. Then in the second case, I spoke about world in plural, in a broader sense, in the sense of different cultures, different kind of world. We can be familiar with one without living in it, without having it, we can have it. Also, we can have at least two of them, two words, and so on and so forth. And I also mentioned, although I have not expanded on this, that our relationship to the past is a problematic relationship and differs very heavily in the case when the past is our past, that we are inheriting this very past, and if this past is a stranger and alien to us, and what we can have is only reconstructed or known it on the superficial level. In this sense, I do not believe in Gadamer's idea about the fusion of the horizons. I think that horizons will never be fused. That's again an illusion that we can have our world as the past world simultaneously. And we cannot have a future world. We cannot have a future because we cannot know the future. The past, and I'm going to talk about it also later on, the past can become the target of nostalgia, and the future can be the target of utopia. Nostalgia is a relationship to the past, and utopia is a relationship to the future. But when we speak about the present, having the world, that is both utopia and nostalgia and living inbuilt in our having the world, in our relationship of mutual dependency, in our pains and pleasures, etc., etc., what we normally call experience. Now I speak about the third concept of words in plural. And we never live in one world alone. We always, constantly live at least in two worlds. At least in two worlds. We live in a world which we can call pragmatic, and we live also in a world which we can call as spiritual, and we live in both worlds. And having ever does not mean only having. A pragmatic word, in having word you have at the same time always a spiritual word. When you grow up as a child, you are 3 years of age. You learn how to use fork and knife, but you also learn the stories of your grandmother. You learn both. And if a girl, or a child in general, goes to the zoo, and the previous evening, grandma read him Little Red Riding Hood, the story of Little Red Riding Hood, about the wolf who swallows Little Red Riding Hood and the grandma. Edition. And then later on the hunter comes and cuts his belly, and the grandma and Little Riding Hood spring out from his belly, wonderfully kiss each other and live happily ever after. And then she reads this story and she knows the story is true. It is a true story. She wants to hear it again and again. Grandma should repeat the story of Little Riding Hood. It is a true story. When the girl goes to the zoo and looks at the wolf in the zoo, and knows that's a wolf. It never occurs to her that this wolf is the kind of wolf which can swallow grandmother and Little Red Riding Hood. Never ever, because she knows that are two birds. A four-year-old child knows there are two birds. One bird of Little Red Riding Hood, and the other bird is the zoo. And not whatever it is. It's a pragmatic word and a spiritual word. That is the word of action, of the rules and norms I obey, and that is the word of narration, the word of stories, the spiritual word, yes, the word of religion, the word of the prayer, the word of the sacred, the word of the beautiful. Lot of things are in this other spiritual word. You know, you have to learn both words, and you live in both words. I would even say that you cannot live a pragmatic life. You cannot have a form of life or a way of life at all without living at least in these two different worlds. And you live in these two different worlds in the so-called most primitive way. If you never leave your village, never ever in your life, if then you live in two different worlds. And that simple why you cannot live otherwise. Because in the pragmatic world, lot of things have meanings. It has a meaning, every sentence has a meaning, of course. But you say, you speak an ordinary language, it has a meaning, Say, mother, come here, don't sentence has a meaning. When you use a thing that listen has a meaning for you, its meaning is the function. Every technical device has a function. And the function is the meaning of this device, obviously. Every habit, every custom has a meaning. I have to greet adults on the street. I have to greet adults before they greet me on the street. That's a habit, it has a meaning. It belongs to politesse and it belongs to the way of life. I cannot deny the verity of this way of life, the relevance of this way of life. No. But it doesn't make sense. All together, because all this together must make sense. The sense, which is the question which was raised by Gauguin in this famous painting. From where did they come from? Where are we going? And what are we? So you always need an answer to the question, what are we doing? What is the sense of life? What is the sense of our life? Why are we here? Where we are? From where have we come? Where are we going? And you can give totally different answers. We are going to the spirits of our ancestors. We are going into the heaven. We can say we are came from the apes or whatever. Or we were created by God. Whatever answer you give, you need to give an answer to the question from where we came and where we go. You need to give an answer. And that's why we always live at least in two different worlds. But we can live in many worlds simultaneously. And only one of these worlds is pragmatic. And very briefly, and that's the last thing I want to tell you today, given that we run out of time, and this is the so-called words of games and words of sciences, they are very rigid. Every word, everything is a word which has norms or rules of their own. Norms of rules of their own. Heidegger called them regional words. See, that was his expression, regional word. For example, the word of mathematics is a regional word. Playing chess is a regional word. You play soccer is a regional verb. You enter this world and you know what the rules are. The rules are different from everyday rules, absolutely. You have to follow the rules of mathematics, you have to follow the rules of the soccer game, you enter a world, you leave the world. This kind of regional verbs belong to your daily life, but not to each and everyone's daily life. It does not belong to a culture. They don't belong to a form of life, because I can share a form of life with someone who is at home in mathematics but totally unfamiliar with philosophy, although I'm unfamiliar with mathematics, cannot play soccer, but I'm familiar with philosophy. We can share the same way of life, although they can step into entirely different kinds of words which are called, as we repeat, regional words. We can enter into different regional worlds and live this regional world. Especially in modern times, these regional worlds became very important due to the development of division of labor. Because the development of division of labor, the importance of this kind of regional worlds became far more widespread and far more characteristic than in previous times. Now this, however, does not change on the situation that we live in this spiritual world and in the pragmatic world simultaneously. And one last word, and this is the following. Nietzsche gave you a beautiful and short description about a story which he told in the following way. How the higher world became a favor, how the true world became a favor. And he said that, of course, the true world was created by the ancient metaphysicians, but now it became a favor because we do not distinguish anymore between true and untrue world. And then he asked the question, what remains when the true world is gone? There will be no untrue world either. This is how far Nietzsche goes. To this I would add the following, that this Nietzsche conception and story can be misinterpreted, because it's misinterpretation that what is left is only one world. Nietzsche and I could never think about this. He meant rather that another true world should be created instead of the other. But I would make a different end to the story. I think there are two worlds. There is a pragmatic and a spiritual world. But we cannot say there is a true world and an untrue world. A world of truth and a world of mere opinion. I can say only there are two worlds. Without distinguishing between true and untrue, and between real truth and mere opinion. But still, we can distinguish between truth and opinion. But since I run out of time, I promise you, since we have a board meeting, that in one of the forthcoming lectures, I will return to this problem, because anyhow, I will expand the issue of the world, even today in the afternoon, and then further on in other 4 days. So, if you wish, I will always return to the question which were left undiscussed and really uninterpreted today. Thank you very much, and now I would like to have your questions for today. Now, I'm very, very, very curious about the questions. The questions I can answer today, I will answer all your questions, but if you have very serious questions, something you consider unilluminated or strange, then I promise to answer it now. will answer it now, then I will answer it in the following lectures, elaborated. So please. My question. Yes, please. Stand up, please.
Yeah. I'd like to put the following question. I mean, the interesting question might be, if I quote you correctly, what are the relations between these different walls? I mean, you say, you talk about these regional walls, and when you play chess, you enter the wall, when you you enter the wall. But then you're doing philosophy, you're talking about different walls, so it might be that there are intrinsic relations between these different walls. This might be an interesting question. No? I mean, they are not isolated, all these walls, aren't they?
The question is very interesting. I don't think that one can give a general answer to your question, because it depends very much on the person who lives in these different worlds. There are, for example, people who live in mathematics, who are so absorbed by mathematics that in their everyday pragmatic life they are totally absent-minded, and they believe that they are always dealing with mathematics, even in their daily life. But not all persons involved in the regional world behave like this. And a wonderful mathematician can still be a very devious friend, and he can be a good friend. He can be an art lover. He can be totally indifferent to art. That is, living in the regional world of mathematics very frequently goes together with living also in the regional world of music. That is a relationship. But does not necessarily go together. You can be very good at looking and following the rules or the language games, as Wittgenstein would have had it, in the regional world of mathematics without being interested at all in the regional world of music or composing. So that is that it is a possible relationship, but it is very individual. And I cannot give an answer on the level, on a theoretical level, because it cannot be generalized. The answer to this question is only it's possible. It can be. It is frequently the case. But I cannot give you such a general answer to this question.
Maybe I didn't put in the
okay.
In the correct way.
I mean, stand up because they don't have this
for example, you're doing philosophy. You're not just doing philosophy. Yeah, in the sense that you're not talking only about philosophy, you're also talking about math or about what truth is or what a wall is, which it should have consequences on the way we live on the walls. In the way we, I don't know, maybe some of the things you have said might have or should have consequences when we come into politics or when we. So it's not only entering or what. Some of your claims have to have consequences with relation to other walls. In this sense, I don't know what the wall means when all these things, all these ways of living are interconnected. And then I don't get the point of talking about different walls, regional walls, when they might be so intertwined.
I understand your question, but I don't think that these regional worlds are interconnected. All of you have been children, because that's obvious. Everyone was a child. And when you were children, you played games. And then you lost or did something, you started to cry. And the adults told you, don't cry, this is only a game. Yeah? That's all, you are only playing, please do not cry. Which means it has no consequences in the pragmatic life. You can lose it if you play a tennis game just for yourself and you lose. You feel very unhappy and just, it has no consequences of your life. Forget it. It doesn't go into it. You have to learn to lose the poker face because you know that it doesn't really matter. If it doesn't matter, if something doesn't matter, then it's not because the rules of the game. is because other kind of rules and dependencies which enter as stranger to the rules of the game. So it happens if you play soccer as a child with your friends, yeah, and you take your court, you put down your court as the game, then that has no consequence. You are happy all of them, but if you get paid for it, big sums, then it's a different matter. But that's an economic relationship. Economic relationship enters not just that you enter a different kind of world, but the other world enters this world, the world of economy, the world of earning money and losing money enters the game. It's not more about the game. You need to know the rules of the game, but you are not suffering or being happy only because you follow the rules of the game. That's a different relationship. That's all kinds of chess too. If you want to be a bird master, it's totally different than chess match with your friends at home. Then you can learn it with your rules, but doesn't influence your life. And even in philosophy, although philosophers normally have the illusion that philosophy makes you more noble and better in your life and makes you ready for understanding other regional worlds as well, I think it is a misunderstanding. It is certainly not the case. And it is in all regional worlds, what is, you play the game of this regional world, and if other worlds enter into it, that's another thing. That's a combination of different worlds. This is at least my, I would say, my world experience.
Because there's a difference maybe between saying that there is an incompatibility between worlds that's neutral, so there's no common measure between the worlds, and then it's interesting to see the different language games that we play in articulating the differences. That's different from saying that there's a potential contradiction between worlds, such that you could be in a pragmatic world out of joint vis-a-vis the spiritual world. So my question would be, in the case of something like ideology, in which you have a spiritual or at least sublimated explanation of something practical, say an economic relationship, in which way then would you construe the potential neutrality between the worlds, which here looks like more of a violent interpenetration?
Yeah, of course. There are connections in a world. If you have a view of life, which is telling your world, it is in itself heterogeneous, not homogeneous. But if you speak about entering a regional world, you think about homogenization of the heterogeneous elements. You homogenize these elements. In a perfect regional world, that's why I mentioned what Heidegger mentions mathematics, a very typical example. All everything is homogenized because everything is quantified. That's a homogenization. You start to homogenize everything when you speak about how many fruits you have and you have five apples and three pieces of cherry. You already homogenize. In this world, they are seven or eight. They are neither cherries nor pears or apples. So the homogenization, you have it in all worlds, regional worlds, they are homogenizing. And in not just in everyday, in your way of life, they are totally heterogeneous elements. And when these heterogeneous elements, they are also participating, homogenized worlds. But the question is not whether the rules contradict the other rules, but the means that a world is a world not with one rule, but with in a way holistic, it's a totality of rules. That's even true about the soccer. There is a totality of rules, not just one rule, there are several rules who are connected in the game itself, also in the chess. And you are free to move within these rules and only within these rules. Otherwise, you cheat in the game. You can cheat in the game, but then you do not move within the rules. You must move within the rules, otherwise you are penalized or you cheat in the game, which is basically outside the game. This homogenizing aspect is very characteristic of the region of Europe. And thus I would not say that there are contradictions between rules in the soccer and rules in life, only that the totality of rules is very simple in every, if, as we say, so very simple in every homogenized medium. It's simple. They are simple. There are few. But these few are the absolute frame within which you are free to move. You cannot move outside because you are not playing the game. You play another game. And that's not so in daily life, not so in your form of life at all. You can say, for example, if I meet and said greeting, somebody, you don't greet somebody on the street. Of course, it is supposed that you do not play the game. But the question can be raised, there might be a reason. Perhaps the other offended you, or perhaps you have noticed me. That's why you haven't greeted yet. But if you get, hey, a soccer, you do something against the rule, the question cannot be raised, why did you do it? What was in your mind? Whether you did it or not? But you are not allowed to do that. Full stop. So there is a difference. Yeah?
Yeah, I want to raise a question which probably connects up some of the concerns that people have had. In the talk today, you've basically been saying in the book Wittgenstein's original proposition that there is an objective world and there are a subjective world. Essentially, that's not a contradiction. This is just talking about different worlds. And there's an obvious sense in which that's true. And nevertheless, somebody who has been the influence on your work, somebody that you didn't mention today, of course, was Hannah Arendt. And of course, one of her big concerns is that modern society is a society which, because of its very dynamics, worldliness in the sense of a world that has stability and permanence seems to be in crisis. The very dynamics of modern society, the emphasis on consumerism and labour, and all of these sort of dynamic aspects, means that one of our traditional understandings of the sort of stability and permanence of the world seems to be something that's in crisis. Now, it seems to me that in your work in general, you have tended to try and allay Arendt's fears by being, in a sense, more postmodernist and talking about the fact that, yes, there is this multiplicity of worlds, and that in the modern world, subjectivization of the world has been, in a sense, a trend both of the world and of cultural development. Yet I know that in your own work, you still have concerns about these trends, and I just wondered, perhaps in response to some of the questions, you'd like to say a little bit more about that, where you see the problems are in terms of this subjectivization of the world.
Thank you for your question. In fact, in this talk, I speak about Hannah Arendt, but I looked at it much.
Yes.
And I left it out, of course. In Hannah Arendt, the problem of work appears in three different contexts. And I'm sorry to say they are contradictory. I don't mind if they are contradictory, but they are contradictory. In one way, he says what I said, coming into the world, having a world, very Heideggerian idea, which she traces back to St. Augustine. Yeah? That to be born, that is being in the world, having a world, is one of her interpretations of the world, which is, in fact, my interpretation, so it's among the my interpretations, at least. Second interpretation for verb is the verb is basically related to work, not to labor and not to action. Because in action there is no verb. The verb is only in creation, in verb which is creation. In creation we create this solid verb in which basically the verb is some, the building. That's the Goethe conception of the verb. He built the house. He built the house in which action takes place. And this is incorporation of the action in writing, incorporation of the action, that is corpus, it's a kind of word, it's a corpus, which is great. But there is a third interpretation, this is the modern, the cultural critical interpretation about the unworthiness of the modern word. The modern, in modernity, there is no word anymore, decreasing, which is there a word. And only labor, only we reproduce ourselves in labor. Labor which is mere life, go forward. Why we do with the word? I don't share this cultural criticism from two positions. Whether they are postmodern or not, I don't know. One position which is on the one, because it's also in a way a dual aspect. On the one hand, Hannah says that we let our blows, our blow, the earth. Then we left the world. Then we went. That is the first act in which we left our earth or the environment of our earth. Then we have already left the world. In this respect, she identifies the world with earth, with our planet Earth, which was the last time it was done. It was in Vermeer's painting. I think that the planet Earth and the world was identified, was never ever identified. Because of course the star, sky above us, is as much the world as the world alone within us. So that was one of our interpretations. That we live in the Earth, we live in the world. I think that's wrong. Simply wrong. The other interpretation was basically that the stability is gone. And the word, what we call a word, needs certain kind of stability, repetition, constant repetition. And in this respect, she has some truth. She has some truth. There is a crisis of the concept of the word in the instability of repetition. In this sense, I think she has something to say, but she transformed everything in that strong kind of culture criticism. And in this respect, I simply disagree with her.
But I mean, just to follow up on that, I mean, your own work on omnivorous culture, right, does talk about what you see as some of the potential threats to the way that sort of culture has functioned in past societies and in our society in terms of giving individuals their world. Fragmentation of culture. Now, isn't there an Arendtian aspect of that in your own work?
Might be, I don't know. Yeah, yes, might be. And the omnivorous character of culture is also contradictory. Because on the one hand, it's, of course, it means a kind of increasing unworthiness. On the other hand, it means absorbing the past in the present, which is basically expansion, a word like world expansion. So as I think I pointed out both aspects. Given my general conception that I will not speak about progress and I cannot speak about regress either, I don't believe in progress, but I don't believe in decadence either. So.
But you are also somebody who believes that that philosophy is not detached from the world, it's something that has an impact on the world, that critique is important.
Yeah, that philosophy has an impact on the world, but philosophy has an impact on the world not to the extent that philosophers live in their own world. That not only as religion and ontology, but as the spiritual world, yeah, which influences, makes sense to the practical pragmatic world. In this sense, that is not in the sense of religion and ontology, but in the sense of the other world, beyond the other world. Religion art philosophy, Vajra Hegel said, absolute spirit, not as regional authority. And it's not philosophy as a faculty, not simply philosophy as a profession, but philosophy as belonging to the absolute spirit. Yes, in this respect, certainly, certainly. It has a critical function, and not just a critical function.
But I mean, in precisely that sense, you were saying before that you don't talk about progress, you don't talk about regress, but to the extent that you think philosophy wants to have a critical function, you're having to make some sort of, you're presupposing some sort of relationship to these existing worlds, aren't you?
Absolutely. The philosophy who speak about regress does a service to the present. But the philosophy speaks about progress also does a service to the present. I think both Rothbard and Hannah Arendt did a service and doing a service to the world in which we live. Yeah? Are both doing a service. Because illuminate different points, different dangers. And there are philosophers who illuminate rather the danger and the other illuminate rather the hope. But both are necessary. Yeah? That's other questions? We should continue in the afternoon rather. Now I think, I don't know who is the chief organizer here, because the next talk will get 12 o'clock. Okay? Then we have a little time for breathing. Yeah, breathing space. Breathing time, breathing space. Okay, thank you. And then you come again in 20 minutes, and then John Wood will give the talk to the orchestra. John, Katie is going to give a talk at 12 o'clock here in the same place, and then we will also discuss.